Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, we are surrounded by symbols. Like, even right now, there are symbols in our midst, on the recording equipment, on our shirts, on our clothing. Well, not yours. You're symbol-free. Is that by design?
Well, I'm wearing black, and you could say that I'm sort of trying to communicate some sort of message here.
Yes, so right an absence here of symbols. But that, in itself, is kind of a symbol.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I embrace the void, and that's what I'm trying to tell people with this. You have your Boards of Canada shirt on.
Yeah, which kind of has a logo symbol thing going on, for sure. And just going through our daily life, just think of how many symbols we encounter. I mean, corporate logos, religious iconography, basic like male bathroom, female bathroom, no parking, wheelchair accessible. I mean, the symbols just completely crowd our world. And even though we don't think about it, those symbols are constantly communicating with us. Our brain is in sync with all of them. And so in this episode, we'd like to really step back and think about symbols, about what they are, how they work, how our brain interfaces with them, and really to what extent they control us.
Yeah, because we're essentially talking about the conceptual life of a stand-in for something else. It's
yes.
How we make meaning of our world. So even something as simple as, say, me working on my computer and seeing a spinning rainbow that looks like a mint, this means something to me. It means that I'm now in the doldrums of uncertainty here.
Yes.
And I'm going to get frustrated pretty soon because an application isn't working, right? Of course, I'm talking about the Mac hypno wheel of doom.
Well, the wheel as a symbol of endless cycle and of frustration. I mean, that's all. I mean, the Buddhist symbol of the wheel is about being trapped in a cycle that won't end. And so, the frustration of the wheel, even that is an old symbol that takes on new meaning in our technological age.
Right. That's really powerful, right?
Mm-hmm.
That this thing can communicate this to us. So signs, as you say, they can take all sorts of forms. Symbols can take all sorts of forms, like signs, words, letters, odors even, flavors. All
yeah.
these things are a stand-in for some sort of experience or some sort of idea, and they have no meaning unless we invest them with meaning and they have context. In fact, semioticians generally say that there are no pure icons. So you mentioned the bathroom icons of the male and the female, those
right.
stick figures. One is wearing a skirt, one is not. But if you are coming from a culture where, say, that the men wear skirts or some sort of clothing.
You mean like a kilted culture? Like a...
I'm not so much Scotland because I feel like they're they're in the know in the West of what those sort of icons mean. But maybe, let's say you were in an undiscovered tribe and then all of a sudden for some reason you were discovered and ferried into a area where there was a Western bathroom.
Well, there's a lot that's going to perplex.
There's
going to
be so
bathroom.
Much that you're trying to take in there, but those symbols aren't necessarily going to mean something to you, particularly if the males wear a clothing item that resemble a skirt.
Right. I mean, clearly that's a person on that sign, that one sign. Is it a male? Is it female? I don't know. It must mean humans go in here, or this is where humans come from. And then likewise, there's another sort of mouse-shaped human. What is that supposed to mean?
Right.
Is it a human? Is it a monster of some kind? A hybrid form?
Yeah. And what is this plumbing thing, this machine I'm supposed to poop in?
Yeah, with the clean water, the drinking water in it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different issues there. But, yeah, all these things are stand-ins for experience. And I wanted to bring up the Marble Man because I feel like in the West, particularly during a certain historical era, the Marble Man was... big. I mean, he was like the symbol of rugged individualism, virility, just like the male dominance.
Yeah, he was virile. He was macho. He's a cowboy. He's smoking. He's not caring. He's everything you would want to be.
He's living off the land. And of course, now we see that and we think a little bit more like a blackened lung. It doesn't quite have the same power that it used to.
So the symbol of the Marlboro Man has kind of shifted, at least for my interpretation, I think for a lot of people's interpretation, based on the shift in our culture.
Right, and I don't think that's a surprise to say that symbols are not static and that they change because our language changes all of the time. It
right.
has to be fluid. It has to in order to deliver those memes that we talked about, right, these ideas that rise to the surface and carry the symbol with them to the greater culture out there.
Yeah, another... A big example of a symbol that's meaning has changed is the swastika. The swastika, of course, is a very old image, and there are various forms of the swastika. There's, of course, the more modern German swastika that was used during the Second World War by the Nazis. You have Hindu swastikas, you have Buddhist swastikas. That dates back all the way to the Indus Valley civilization. And if you look back at Zoroastrian religion of Persia, mm-hmm. The swastika was more a symbol of a revolving sun, of infinity, of continuing creation. And if you weren't exposed to the 20th century, the swastika might still inspire that in your mind because, I mean, that's the basic form of the thing, the motif of the thing. There's a sense of cycle to it and a very sun-like imagery in it. But we come into it with our knowledge of the 20th century, with our knowledge of the Nazis, of all that transpired during the Second World War and the Holocaust, and so all of that gets factored into the image. So an image that for the longest time just stood for basically very positive ideas and powerful ideas becomes this dark image of hatred.
Right. It was appropriated, and it's now what is the stand-in for what it formerly was. So, again, this idea that it can change, that it's fluid. And this made me think of the Pioneer plaque.
Ah, yes.
Because this is a great example of not just the changing ideas we have of what the human species is or should be represented, but also a great example of how powerful symbols are. Because how do you try to communicate with the universe? You try to boil down the earth and the human experience with a couple of symbols, which is exactly what happened when the Pioneer plaque was put on the Pioneer probe that was launched in 1972.
Yeah. I mean, the idea here was let's sum up who we are, where we are, in an attempt to possibly communicate with an extraterrestrial species, or at the very least to serve as kind of a time capsule to say it's kind of like the human race as a pair of lovers carving their name into a tree. That's kind of
and ultimately
that's kind of how Sagan saw it too. More of a time capsule and less of an actual communication, but still it was created in the name of communicating with another species.
Yeah, and we're talking about simple line drawings that are engraved mm-hmm. in this plaque. So it has diagrams of the Earth's location and drawings of a nude man and a nude woman.
Yeah.
Now, very simple and straightforward, right? But if you look at this a little bit closer, you notice that the man has his hand up as if he's waving.
Or as if he has a question. There's something he doesn't understand.
Yeah, or if he's just checking the wind direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or he's hailing a cab.
Or he's stretching,
yeah. Or he's got some sort of like a weird limb thing where his arm just rises.
Oh,
up.
Alien hand syndrome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's got his hand up and the female does not. And if you look at this, you could start to say, ah, okay, I can infer here that this man, he is the signifier, the form that an idea takes. And what is being signified is the concept. So the concept here is that the man is the representative for the human species,
mm-hmm.
that he is the person who is trying to communicate. And if you really, really start to look at this closely, then from the perspective of humans, of course, because we can occupy no other perspective, you begin to understand that there is a hierarchy involved here, even though we're talking about very simple line drawings. Now, is this representative of the culture right now in 2013?
Because we were closed now, unlike we did back then.
Yeah. Well, there might be a different kind of plaque that was sent out to try to communicate what we are who we are.
I think maybe the male and female would be a little more equal in that. Now, of course, the plaque involves some other stuff, too. It showed the hyperfine transition of neutral hydrogen. It showed relative position of the sun to the center of the galaxy in 14 pulsars, solar system, the spacecraft, you know. But certainly the depictions of us are central there. And there are a number of criticisms to make. Obviously there are the cultural implications of the whole raising of the hand. What does that mean? But would another culture understand that? Would extraterrestrials who don't have arms, who say have tentacles instead, what would they make of this? Would they understand the hand signifier? Or even if they had hands, perhaps in their culture, it's more of a, they might say, oh, well, look, the man is clearly the subservient of these two because he has to rush forward and eat the food that the other creature is going to eat later. You know, they might have some sort of weird connotation that totally skews it.
Well, of course, and that's where the context is everything, right?
Yeah. And what if raising your hand to another culture is the equivalent of putting up the middle finger? Like, imagine the pioneer plaque.
Well, then we're screwed.
If he was flipping off the other species. I mean, then you get also into things like, for instance, the arrows are used on that plaque.
Mm-hmm.
And would the arrow as a symbol make sense to a species that never used a bow and arrow, never used a javelin, that didn't have some sort of hunter-gatherer ancestry? Or as we were talking about earlier, you said, should they have had a child on there? And that made me think of the fossil record, where we're always running into these situations when we're looking at dinosaur bones, where we say, now, is this a different creature, or is this the mm-hmm. female of the species? Is this merely an infant of the species? So you can imagine a situation where they might look and not realize that they're dealing with two genders. Because what if the aliens looking at this plaque did not have genders? What if they had five genders? You know, what would they make of this? How would they interpret it?
Right. So, I mean, it's kind of hard to try to make something that would really make sense unless you have an understanding of how another culture or civilization or species would conceive of it. So,
yeah. But still, it's a really fine attempt to boil down a lot of information into a very concise package. And that's ultimately what's so amazing
yeah.
about symbols.
Well, but I also think that the Pioneer plaque is largely for us as humans.
Yes,
it's the excitement of saying, guess what? We're humans. This is what we look like.
We're cool. Here's our name written on the tree.
Here's our coordinates, right? Here's some of the stuff that's in our atmosphere.
But yeah, this is what I love about symbols, is that a symbol can be something very simple, like the at symbol,
mm-hmm.
or the proposed the symbol, which looks like a T and an H.
Yeah.
That where all you have is, okay, you have some letters that are symbols, and those symbols make a word that is a symbol for something. And then we have a slightly smaller, more concise symbol to represent that word or that concept. But then you have, again, things like the swastika, things like the Marlboro Man, things like the Pioneer Plaque, where the symbol instantly conveys a lot of data. And if you had to describe, even to like in modern terms, what a swastika means, what a crucifix means, what a Marlboro Man means, you're talking like a whole essay. You'd have to sit there and write it out. You'd have to sit there and use a verbal language to describe it for, 5 minutes or so, whereas the symbol, instantly.
That's right, because you get it coded in your brain, and then you just bring it up and up again. We'll talk about that a little bit more when we talk about how our brain works on symbols. Side note, do we really need a symbol for the? That's TH. I mean, are we that lazy? It's one letter.
Well,
it's just the E.
It would make tweets easier and texting easier, but there are a lot of people that argue that it is unnecessary. But it is a very commonly used word.
I know, but you're losing one letter. That's it.
Well, see, I mean, and we can really go. We could go ahead and just reduce it to TH to cut out one letter, or just reduce it to duh, DA.
Okay, I have an idea about that.
Yeah.
But I want to save it until we talk about the brain.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So to make this case, we also wanted to talk about Neanderthals and crows, because they figure into this symbolic representation as well.
Yes. So Neanderthals, of course, our hominid brethren who are no longer with us, people before people. We did an entire podcast episode about these ladies and gentlemen. And they're always endlessly fascinating because they are before us. They are different from us.
Mm-hmm.
They are, in a sense, as close as we can get to an extraterrestrial being. You know, I mean, they're terrestrial, obviously, but they are like us, but unlike us.
Well, and we have some of their DNA.
Right.
We know this.
Yeah. So we were looking at this particular study where archaeologist Zhao Zihao of the University of Bristol in England and his colleagues found 50,000-year-old perforated painted seashells and pigment containers on the Iberian Peninsula in southwestern Europe. And this was a region that was inhabited solely by Neanderthals at the time. Modern humans who lived in Africa at the time used similar objects as jewelry and for body painting to symbolize, you know, their various social standing, etc. But this particular study, this particular find, suggests that the brains of the common ancestor of both species must have already had the biological basis for symbolic thought. So way back then, they were using these shells, they were using pigments as a way mm-hmm. to signify roles and positions within their society.
Yeah, I mean, Zelhau is saying that they had the biological basis for symbolic thought dating back about 500,000 years ago, because he says assigning specific meanings to arbitrary words and sounds is symbolic thinking by definition.
Yeah.
So it really makes you think about how this was the predecessor for actual language.
Yeah, it boils down to one of the hallmarks of the human species, and to their point, some predecessors of humans as well, about what makes us so successful, and that's our ability to externalize internal processes, such as cooking, of course, is externalizing internal digestion. And symbolic thought is essentially externalizing aspects of our thinking that free up our cognitive abilities so that we can maximize what we're doing internally.
Of course, all of this is predicated on the idea that we have to survive. And in order to survive, we've got to be able to suss out these symbols and figure out our universe. And you have to look at crows as a really good example of this. We are talking about crows capable of distinguishing symbols. This was from a study led by Shoei Sugita, who used 8 jungle crows, relatives of the American crow, by the mm-hmm. way. And the Japanese scientists also found that the jungle crows were able to determine which container that they had in front of the crows held food and which did not, based on a symbol system.
Yeah, one of the containers would have either a 2 or a 5.
Yeah, and they had a pretty, like, a 70% success rate.
Mm-hmm.
And they did about 20 different experiments with food and symbols, and eventually the crows clocked in at about 70 to 90% success rate as they did this more and more matching food to symbol. So we know that this is just a very basic, rudimentary skill that all animals have, including humans, in order to suss out how to get to what we need.
All right, well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to discuss language, we're going to discuss symbols some more, and we're going to discuss how symbols interact with our brain. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, we're back. And let's talk a little bit about language. What is language and how it relates to symbols? I mean, ultimately, as we were talking about earlier, we're talking about externalizing internal processes. We're talking about using them as kind of footholds as we ascend to more complicated topics. Basically the use of words, verbal or written, signifiers and symbols. They represent ideas, and when they're combined, they allow us to build more complicated ideas.
That's right. So it is basically the way that we navigate our world. We just do not think of it that way, because language, each letter is a symbol, right?
Yeah.
Each word, each phrase, each paragraph has more and more meaning that's built upon it, more and more symbols that become these shorthands. And you begin to look around, you know, widen your scope a little bit, and you see that the traffic signals that direct you, whether or not you're taking a train or you're driving in a car, there are all sorts of navigational signals that are telling you how to order your world.
Yeah, and we've discussed before the idea, too, that language is essentially the operating system for the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
That we have all the hardware, and then language is what we use to actually think about things and to actually tackle concepts.
Yeah, it's something like the periodic table of elements, right? This is a good example of symbols and us trying to make the invisible world visible to us, albeit in this form, where we can try to figure out the properties of each element.
Yeah, because of the periodic table, obviously, it's not a true map. It's not a place. It's summing up a lot of things that are invisible or are a lot more complicated, and taking that, boiling it down into a version of reality that makes sense even at a quick glance. You look at it, the periodic table, and you realize this is the scientific underpinning of the substances that make up physical reality.
Yeah, even the coordinates on it have a meaning to them, right? So if you're looking at a certain vertical column, then you know that they all share similar properties.
Yeah, and even though it's not a true map, it is a map of sorts. So
that's just an example of our outer universe that we are ordering, but we also are ordering our inner universe. And I can't help but bring up Carl Jung.
Yes.
Of course, the Swiss psychoanalyst.
Because you're a Jungian.
I don't know that I'm a Jung. I'm I appreciate Jung, and I have the Red Book, which is a bunch of his drawings of the unconscious via symbols, and it's fascinating and beautiful and also kind of horrific too, because he's using these archetypes, these symbols, to try to delve into the mind, into the unconscious. And so what he was doing is trying to use this universality of symbols to suss out the human experience, the inner world.
Yeah, and we've all looked at like dream interpretation guides before, where they talk about what these different symbols mean. What does it mean if you're falling? If you're falling in a dream, then it means that that bad stuff may happen during the daylight. If you're being chased through streets, the same thing. If your flesh is turning into tree roots, then it means you're gonna get disease. You know, people look for all sorts of portents in this kind of imagery. But it boils down to the idea that symbols are that powerful. They connect with the subconscious. And if you want to apply supernatural thinking to it, you might think that symbols also connect us to hidden knowledge outside of ourselves.
And you should also look at it like dreams. They don't come to you in a highly realistic way. They come to you fully symbolically packaged, right? You don't necessarily read a book in your dream, right? Or I've tried to, actually, in my dreams, but it's always blurry or something. You get pounded over the head with all these different archetypes. And so it's very clear that this is important to the operating system of our brains in a way to try to figure out what's been going on. I mean, I think it's fascinating that it's represented to us in that way.
Yeah. Now, another area of symbolic use that has always fascinated me, and going back to the idea of adding supernatural elements to it, is the use of sigils, symbolic representations of demons or a wizard's desired outcome. And then you also have hyper sigils, such as this was popularized by Grant Morrison, the writer of graphic novels, who saw a hyper sigil as an extended work of art with magical meaning and willpower. So like a comic book or a novel or a movie where it's a bunch of symbols that are put together in a way to where the symbols kind of overlap to form some greater symbol. So I always find that interesting as well. And in a sense, a really crazy dream is a kind of hypersigil.
It is. And if you want to check out some of the archetypes that have been collected by ARIS, this is the Archive for Research in Archetypal Symbolism, go to ARIS.org. You can kind of browse a little bit. You do have to become a member to check out the full catalog. But it is an amazing amount of symbolic, mythological, ritualistic images that you can search, and then it actually gives you not just the accompanying information about what it means, but it will tell you during what periods of history that it was in popular use in what regions of the world. So it's fascinating.
So we've plowed through what symbols are, why they're important to us, how powerful their communication is, how about how a symbol can instantly convey something that would take you paragraphs and paragraphs to completely spell out, that they can sum up things that are impossible even to completely relate with language. But how do they interact with the brain itself?
All right, so the brain is going to try to visualize a symbol in three different ways. This is according to information designer Ted Wujak, who has a TED Talk on this. And he says that the brain doesn't actually see the world as it is, but instead creates a series of mental models. And we've talked about this before, too, to get to those aha moments. And David Eagleman talks about this a lot, too, that the unconscious usually kind of burps up an idea. And you have that aha moment, but you don't realize that it's been that idea has been worked on for months, maybe even years before it's served up.
Nobody's view of the real world is actually the real world. It is just a world view that we take on. It's a simulation, in a sense.
So what happens? What happens before this symbol emblazons itself in our minds? Well, of course, it begins with the eyes. You have light entering, hitting the back of the retina, and it's circulated mostly to the back of the brain, to the primary visual cortex. But then, according to Wujak, it acts like a relay station that re-radiates and redirects information to other parts of the brain. So we're talking about 30 different parts of the brain that get in on this. But there are three really important ones. The first one is the ventral stream. And this is the part of the brain that recognizes what something is. So if I look at my hand, that's the what. That's my hand. That's a book. That's a remote control. The second one is the dorsal stream. And what this does is it locates the object and it creates a mental map in your mind. The third one is the limbic system, which we've talked about a lot in terms of processing emotion. So that's the part that feels like, oh, the aha, the emotional response to what that symbol begins to mean, the form that it's taking as an abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And this combination of these processing centers help us to make meaning in a bunch of different ways.
So one way to understand how symbols interact with the mind is to look at how children learn language. And some of the materials we're looking at, they're talking about how when children are learning language, symbol use in the prefrontal cortex, that's where all the activity is taking place. But then as they become accustomed to what these symbols mean, to what language means, the parietal region takes over the job. The associations become more automatic. So it comes back to this idea of symbols as a placeholder for more complex thought. In a sense, it's kind of like we figure out what that basic idea is, we form an idea of what this is about, and then we assign it that symbol, and then that symbol squared away. In the same way that we might circle a paragraph in a book we're reading and then mark it with a signal, like maybe just a star. That star signifies this is an important passage, and it's a passage that I need to come back to. And so, in a sense, we do the same thing with our symbolic understanding of the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you see that in kids, right? That they begin to shorthand that knowledge so that it can be mapped out in their brain so they can recall it later. And it reminds me of another study that we saw that talked about how expectations speed up conscious perception.
Right.
So those archetypes that you learn, turns out that when you're taking in a bunch of stimuli, if you recognize that symbol, well, then we're talking about your ability to speed up your processing by something like 100 milliseconds. Now, that doesn't sound huge, but just consider that when you're taking in data, it usually takes about 300 milliseconds for it to get perceived. So if you can cut that down by about 30% by those archetypes, that's when the T-H-E to the T-H sort of makes sense, right?
Yeah, because it's kind of like, how do you win a war? You can win a war with overwhelming force, but a lot of times if the two sides are more equal, you win a war, you win a battle, with a lot of petty advantages that stack up. So all that lost time, all that gain time, 100 milliseconds here, 100 milliseconds there, it's eventually going to potentially make the difference when you're having to think on your feet really fast and choose that, you know, make that saber-toothed tiger-related decision in your modern life.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you are saving a hundredth millisecond every single time that you're taking in a new piece of data, then you are conserving a lot more energy. And now, I'm not a fan of cutting down T-H-E to T-H, but its prevalence in the language, I do understand that there is a conservation of energy in the act.
Yeah, I mean,
of naming.
Well, you don't want to boil language. It down so much that you don't think. And I think that's one of the problems that sometimes occur with symbols is that they are so powerful that they are cutting out our reasoning and depending on existing thought that they're kind of viral. There's a viral power to symbols, especially within certain cultures. You know, depending on how resonant it is. Like again, I come back to the swastika. About how powerful the swastika becomes as the symbol of hate in modern society to the point where it's, for instance, you know, it's outlawed in Germany. You can't go around publishing a swastika on things, even if it's a historically accurate model airplane. Then, if you're buying the kit in Germany, you need to see about acquiring your swastika separately.
Now, so we were talking about this on our commute full of signs this morning about how this sort of shorthand placement stand-in our brains is really, really helpful, right? Because it's like shortening the T-H-E to T-H. But it can be a problem because what you're talking about is unconscious stereotyping. And we don't necessarily know that we're always doing this, but when we're taking in data and we're thin slicing, as Malcolm Gladwell might say, in Blink, we're trying to get that really quick perception. And most of the time that helps us out a lot, but it can really actually show up as errors in our thinking. And it made me think about this study that came up about foreign languages and people using a second language to consider high-risk scenarios. The study is called The Foreign Language Effect: Thinking in a Foreign Tongue Reduces Decision Biases, which documents a series of experiments on more than 300 people from the U.S. and Korea. And this is from a Wired article by Brian Keem, who says that human reasoning is shaped by two distinct modes of thought, one that's systematic, analytical, and cognition intensive, and the other that's fast, unconscious, and emotionally charged, right? That's mm-hmm. the feelings that we get, that limbic system coming into play. So the idea is that the cognitive demands of thinking in a non-native language would leave people with a little leftover mental horsepower, ultimately increasing their reliance on quick and dirty cogitation, right? Just that quick analytical. And they did. They found that in the study, that people were able to make better, more rational decisions when working in their second language as opposed to their mother tongue, which was freighted with emotion.
Because you're stepping outside of culture. You're stepping outside of self.
Mm-hmm. You're stepping outside of symbol to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Because if that symbol, I mean, that symbol will mean something to you, but it's going to mean something different in a second language, which has distance from what was ingrained in your brain when you were being brought up in this one language.
It comes back to that idea of language as an operating system. One language is Mac, one language is PC, and certain things are going to travel from one to the next, but some aren't. In Neal Stephenson's book Snow Crash, which is one of his earlier novels, a cyberpunk classic, these days, rather different from some of his more recent work. But there's a great deal in that book that has to do with the trend towards divergence in language and about how the fact that we have various languages in the world actually prevents and protects us from widespread harm. So, you know, we all know the story of a farmer grows only one crop, then his entire farm is susceptible to devastation by a single parasite. So Stephenson draws in the idea that, say, Nazism is a cultural virus. And if you have a universal language, mm-hmm. then that cultural virus is more has more potential to spread to everyone.
Hmm.
So that kind of factors into what you're saying there.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time-ins? time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about how our behavior is altered and our ideas are altered by symbols. And I'm thinking specifically about Adam Alter, the psychologist.
Yeah, this is the guy who wrote the book on Drunk Tank Pink, which deals also a lot with color theory. And hopefully we'll come back and do an episode on color theory if there's interest out there in us covering that topic. But he pointed out that Christians tend to behave more honestly when they're exposed to an image of a crucifix, even when they have no conscious memory of having seen it. So there's just a cross, and the cross is a lot like the swastika, and in a sense, a cross and a swastika are at very base level the same thing. I mean, both are cruciform. And there are a lot of different crucifixes out there, depending on which creed you're adhering to. But the idea that just in the background, just this one image that's heavily charged with meaning and religious purpose, that even if you see it and you're not even consciously processing it, it's jumping over your conscious thought into the unconscious and affecting the way you're feeling, the way you're thinking, really hacking your entire mindset.
What about Pope John Paul II?
Yes, this was a 1989 experiment from the University of Michigan, and this one found that Christians felt less virtuous after subliminal exposure to an image of Pope John Paul II.
I mean, it's because he has, well, the idea is that there are impossible high standards to live up to, right?
Yeah, so some of our younger listeners may not remember John Paul all that much, but he had more of a peaceful, grandfatherly kind of demeanor for a lot of people.
Well, and in terms of popularity, isn't he more like a bit of a rock star in terms of the popedom?
Yeah, definitely so. So he was a very, he himself became a symbol. And merely glancing around and catching it was influencing the way people thought about themselves.
Now, what about a computer logo? You think that could make you feel more creative,
more
inspired?
I don't know about me, because I'm not as much of a Mac person. I mean, I think they make some great products, but I'm not one of the, I don't have the bumper sticker on my car or anything. But studies have found that when people are exposed to that Mac symbol, they are more likely to think creatively. And likewise, if they're exposed to a symbol of an incandescent light bulb, the whole, oh, I've got an idea.
Yeah.
And then the light bulb lights up. If they're exposed to that, they're likely to think creative, because these are both symbols that are charged with ideas of creative endeavor. And so just by glimpsing them, they hook into our subconscious and make us think about that.
Now, that's a 2008 study by Fitzsimmons et al. So you have to wonder if 2013, does Apple have the same staying power? Again, we've talked about fluidity of symbols and their meanings.
Yeah, because a lot of stuff has happened. The product itself has arguably taken a dive in some people's, maybe not a dive, but let's say a decline. But then on the other hand, Steve Jobs' passing, there was that made everyone really nostalgic for Apple and really celebrate his contributions to our technological life. And then, of course, you also have had varying bits of scandal about how our Apple devices are made,
right?
Which may also add new nuance to the symbol itself. So again, these symbols become dependent on all the cultural things feeding into them. They're kind of like a tree growing out of the ground, and the root system runs throughout our culture. And even into our history. And it depends on how far those roots are going and what they're sucking in, what kind of nutrients they're drawing from our culture, to depend on what the form of that tree is.
Yeah, it's interesting that one symbol can bring up so many different threads of thought, because you have the biography of Steve Jobs, you have nations and their economics being powered or not powered by Apple. You have people who are being affected at just the level of not only pay, but what they're exposed to in terms of the technologies that they're using.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this idea of creativity.
Yeah.
All wrapped up into one tiny logo.
Yeah. So it's important to think about these experiences, not because we want to make a definite point about crosses and Christians and Apple fans, but bear in mind that all symbols are interacting with us to varying levels like this. So we encounter them subconsciously or even a little bit consciously, and they're having some sort of an impact on us. If it's the McDonald's golden arches, if it's the Coca-Cola or the Pepsi symbol, if it's a cross, if it is the Star of David, if it's a swastika, whatever. Like, we encounter these and they convey something to us. And then if you start combining them, if you say slap a swastika on Ronald McDonald, then it's instantly going to create some sort of new unsteady symbol and convey that to your mind.
He just gave someone a really great art project idea.
Oh, I'm sure it's probably already been. I was somewhere, I was on Paris on Ponce, and they have a Ronald McDonald there that's made out of something. What is it made out of?
Oh, yeah. No, I know.
Other corporate logos or something?
Yeah, it's like an 8-foot tall. I mean, Ronald McDonald, in my eyes, has always been menacing, but this one is particularly menacing. But yeah, it's made out of corporate logos.
Yeah, so in a way, it becomes kind of a hyper-sigil itself, because you're combining these various symbols that stand for things into another symbol. And but then you get into situations, too, where if you combine too many symbols, is it kind of like combining all the Crayola crayons, where you end up with just a blur? You end up with things like the rose, right? As Umberto Eco points out, the rose has symbolized so many different things mm-hmm. that it pretty much becomes devoid of meaning. It's kind of that the symbol has been completely worn out to the mm-hmm. point where it cannot convey any true message anymore.
One of the lines of philosophy that I really like about this is from Louise Althusser. Hopefully I've said that correctly. And he described our existence as being tied to something called the ideology state apparatus. And it's this idea that we're always ready. We're always already. And by always already, what he means is that we are, even before we're born into this expectation and this embodiment of symbols. And so even when you are gestating in your mother's uterus, you are the symbol of whatever it is that society is going to put upon you. So if you're a girl, you're going to be wrapped in pink and all sorts of expectations. And it's a very interesting idea. He says that it's the way that we're defined, that we are walking symbols. And essentially that allows us, or I shouldn't say allows, but those expectations give us a roadmap on how to behave.
Yeah.
So it's this idea of being both objectified but also subjected as a placeholder in language.
Hmm. You know, it reminds me, too, of execution, torture, and even imagined execution and torture as we encountered in our study of hell. Various sins are punished varying ways. And there's a strong argument that any form of real-life torture or execution and any kind of imagined form, like those are all symbols. The idea of executing somebody in a certain fashion, mm-hmm. it's loaded with symbolic meaning, especially when you deal with public executions, because you are creating a symbol to try and illustrate a point and convey a message to the populace.
That's interesting. So a hanging would be very different from having your head cut off, right? With
yeah.
a guillotine. So
yeah, what does it mean? What does being drawn and quartered mean? What does being thrown into a sack with live animals mean? Like, all of these bear certain symbolic messages for the intended audience.
To be absorbed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I could go on this kind of thing, too, but it also reminds me of the works of Bosch, all those hellish apocalyptic sceneries where you have all these strange monsters doing strange things and tormenting people and all that. Like, even a scene like that, we don't understand a lot of it, but to the individuals who would have viewed that work of art at the time, loaded with symbols, known symbols. And so in a sense, that painting is speaking a language of symbols to the viewer.
And if you would like to actually experience these symbols firsthand in the form of a Buddhist hell theme park, we actually found out yesterday that there is one in Singapore.
Yes.
Where you can go and look at all these visual representations of what Buddhist hell might be.
Yeah, it looks amazing. And I know we have listeners all over, so if any of you are in Singapore or end up traveling there or have traveled there and have visited that place, do let us know all about it.
Symbolic rich, that one.
Yep. All right, well, there you go. A crash course in symbols. Like I say, if nothing else, I just hope that this makes you a little more alert to the power of symbols and how loaded our lives are with symbols. How they're very useful to us. They are footholds in the mountain of understanding that allow us to ascend and learn new things and grapple with concepts that are really too much for our puny minds to deal with without the advantage of language, but then also about how all these symbols around us are constantly influencing us and arguably controlling us. On that word, let's call over the robot. All right, so this is an interesting one. This comes to us from Isabel von Finkelstein. She writes in about our Sideshow Secrets episode. She says, "Hello, listening to the Sideshow Secrets episode. My grandma on my mum's side was apparently one of the headless women in Blackpool in England. She also swallowed swords and read tarot. Apparently, my great-grandpa ended up joining the circus at 14 after stabbing someone in the leg and running away. He ended up with tuberculosis and then somehow was picked up by the carnies. So my grandma was brought up with them. Given that my family sways to the theatrical and creative side of life, we weren't at all surprised that she had circus in the genes. It explained a lot, haha. I just wish I knew more of the history. I have a copy of a newspaper cutting somewhere. If I can find it, I'll forward it on to you. Again, another great podcast. I need to finish listening to it now. Thanks, guys. Isabel."
Wow, and I thought that my family's history was colorful.
I know, that's amazing. And, of course, Blackpool, England is... kind of a historically like a vacation area, like a little bit of a carny town in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that professional wrestler Steven Regal hails from there.
And so there's
the wrestling that is a part of the carny,
right?
And all that.
Yeah, it's part of the whole tradition.
Yeah,
that also reminded me of the book Geek Love.
Yes,
did we bring that up in the last podcast?
Sometimes there's a reference that's so key that we actually forget to bring it up when we do the podcast episode.
I know. And we're like, oh, I can't believe we didn't mention that. Geek Love by Catherine Dunn. Amazing fictionalized account of the carnival world and a fictional family that is created essentially by the parents by messing with genes to create sideshow kids.
It sounds good. I have not read it. I hear great things. I know they locally did a production of it years ago. It was like six hours long.
Yeah. 6 hours.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to go ahead and leave you. But in the meantime, if you have something you would like to share with us, go for it. Particularly related to symbols. What is your experience with symbols? How do you interact with them? Are you conscious of what symbols are doing to you? Is there a symbol that is particularly important to you? Let us know about it. I was talking earlier about how a symbol instantly conveys something that would take you a little more time to explain in words. So explain in words to us why a symbol is important to you and what it means to you when you look at it. We'd love to hear that kind of thing. And you can find us in all the normal places. Our main website, of course, is stufftoblowyourmind.com. We're also on Facebook and Tumblr at Stuff to Blow Your Mind. And on Twitter, we go by the handle Blow the Mind. And then, YouTube, Mind Stuff Show. That's where we are there.
Okay, and there are two things I'm interested in hearing from you guys about. Yay or nay on the THE versus TH. The second thing today, there was a story about Mattel and NASA creating a Barbie a Mars Barbie.
Yeah.
Who's clad in pink. Progress or no? Let us know, and you can do so by sending us an email at blowthemind@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.